So first of all, thank you very much for having this interview with us. So my first question is that there has been concerns that due to the food hoarding frenzy during the COVID-19 lockdowns, the food price could actually increase dramatically. But FAO food price index in May went down 1.9%, reaching the lowest monthly average since December 2018. So why is that?
So essentially, the fact that the price has not risen, but in fact has dropped, this is most likely because there are ample food stocks globally. The weather has generally been good, and the production prospects, are also good. It's important to note that governments and the private sector have done their best to ensure that supply chains remain functional and they meet the demand. Some countries did impose export restrictions initially, but then they removed them later. So the hoarding frenzy was probably an initial reaction to the lockdowns, and maybe in some countries, but not everywhere. And once people realized that there were not going to be food shortages, the hoarding then actually reduced. So that's actually a part of the reason why the price did not increase dramatically. The second thing, and which will become more serious in probably in the days to come, is the impact of lost incomes due to job losses. So this has also negatively influenced demand and contributed to a drop in prices. So what actually FAO has said previously, and it's also there on the numerous policy briefs on the website, is that the impact of COVID-19 on food prices is ambiguous. It depends on the local context, but we continue to monitor the situation and we inform all countries on the price trends as the lockdowns begin to end.
As many countries are reaching the end of the lockdown, how to ensure food safety and hygiene in each phase of the food supply chain, which is getting more and more complicated than ever?
First of all, it's very important to say that there is no evidence that COVID-19 is transmitted by food or its packaging. Therefore, the risks to food safety are those that we already know. One is physical contamination, which is due to unwanted particles in food. Second is chemical contamination, so contamination above what we call as maximum residue levels, which could be from pesticides or heavy metals or antimicrobials. And these can come in at various points in the chain, along the farm to fork chain. And then foodborne microbes such as E. coli, Salmonella. And they usually cause, diarrhea, which is a common symptom of foodborne illness. Now, a study by WHO a few years ago, it showed very clearly that foodborne microbes are like the key problem in the Asia-Pacific region, particularly due to a lack of hygiene in this region, as well as specifically in the Pacific because of a lot of parasites. So for all these food safety problems, there are good practices and standards that are widely available. So you have good hygiene practices, which are critical right now, good agriculture practices, good aquaculture practices, good manufacturing practices, and so on. Now, these are codes of practice which can be put in place across transcontinental supply chains. And they are already doing that, have been doing so. That's why we have the extensive trade in food across the world and across very long supply and value chains. And there are global standards such as those of the FAO-WHO Codex Alimentarius Commission, which can be freely adopted and used, and that is actually being done. So food safety risks can actually be mitigated by adopting a lot of these standards and good practices. In addition, what COVID now has brought is we need to incorporate the health measures, so physical distancing, extensive hand hygiene, so frequent washing, hand sanitizers, and so on. The use of masks, the use of PPE, personal protection equipment, then good habits like we touch only what we need to touch. Don't touch everything that you can get your hands on. So these sorts of measures will have to be strictly adopted by the food businesses. And then some additional things like contact tracing. We need to know who's who in the food supply chain. So, and we need to have that person's number and contact. So if there's a case in the chain, then all the people can be informed. So it's important that we need to make sure that there's no person in the chain who actually could be a suspected case or has the potential to pass on to other people. Now, the good thing about all these measures that have come is that they have become so widespread, people are very aware across the globe, and this will have a positive impact on food safety.
So on this year's World Food Safety Day, the FAO called on everyone to play a role. So in terms of the general public, what would be your message to them?
The general message to the public would be participate in food safety, because we are all part of the solution. In food safety, the government sets the regulatory framework. The private sector industry, and that includes the big companies as well as the MSMEs, the SMEs, street food vendors, everybody, they implement standards and good practices. And our responsibility as consumers is that we should implement good practices at home, at the workplace, at school and colleges, wherever we go. And cleanliness, hygiene, and sanitation are very important, which we can do it ourselves. So we need to do our part in food safety and not just expect that the industry and the government will do and we don't have a role. We have a very important role. The other important thing that we need to do in these times is to verify news. There's a lot of fake news on food and food safety, and it is leading to people not consuming otherwise healthy food. So when we receive social media messages or any such news, let's check them first. And fact checking now is probably becoming as important as hand washing.
How did COVID-19 impact food security from planting to our plates? What is the current situation in Asia Pacific region, where many countries face a complex of crises such as pests and the extreme weather? And how did your office respond to the negative impacts, particularly caused by the COVID-19?
The influence on food security could start coming because of the loss of jobs and incomes, which lowers the ability of populations, especially the more vulnerable ones, to access food. Now, governments in Asia and the Pacific region have responded with a lot of measures, like supplying free food grains to social and as well as social protection payments. And at the same time, the civil society and charities, they've also stepped up and they're also providing meals. Now, the real test in terms of food security will come now, because the lockdowns are ending and the populations have to now go back to their jobs to support themselves. And there is in Asia a large population in the what is called as the informal or the unorganized sector. So they have to regain their jobs to support themselves. So the real test will be to stop a resurgence of the virus, which then stops the people from returning to their jobs or starting again their livelihoods. So as long as we can ensure that, both governments and civil society, then we can probably have ensured that there will not be very high levels of food insecurity from here on. What does FAO do and what has it been doing over the last few months to support governments and the populations in our member countries? So we have been providing continuously policy advice on keeping supply chains functional, and suggesting ways to transport perishable food to markets, and then how to keep transport open to enable provision of inputs, you know, seed, feed, fertilizer, and other things that are needed for farming. Then we have been providing advice on social protection, how to incorporate health measures into food safety practices, and reorienting some of our ongoing projects into supporting the government with assessing the impacts of COVID-19. And what are the mitigating measures in place? So for instance, one of the responses that many governments want to implement is to increase local food production, particularly that of vegetables. That is one way to reduce import dependence and make the country more self-sufficient. At the same time, you know, you mentioned these critical issues that are affecting Asia. So we have operational projects in all the countries which are in our region, which are affected by locusts. And this is an ongoing process because it's a regional issue. So controlling in one country is not enough. All four of them, in this case, it's Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and India. All four of them have to work together, and they're actually doing that. So our eventual long-term objective, obviously, is that we need agriculture to be more resilient. And there are so many millions of smallholders in this region that we need to support them to have sustainable livelihoods and be resilient in their in farming.
So as you mentioned that we need a more sustainable and resilient agriculture, Are there any specific steps or strategies that the FAO has taken to build a more sustainable and resilient food system?
Yeah, I think this is where you're now coming into the question on the food system. So what FAO, and in fact a number of our agents, our sister agencies, including WFP, UNICEF, have all been advocating, is to have a sustainable food systems approach. So this is a more holistic approach to food production, to nutrition, and to sustainability, so that we actually have many results, many good outcomes for people and the environment at the same time, while ensuring that there is sufficient production. So production needs to be, you know, well balanced. You need to have enough local and not actually say no to trade as well. You need to have both. So how much can you produce internally? How much you need to source through trading? That's one where, which needs to be part of the approach. So the policy making needs to ensure a balance of these two issues. The second thing is to have a balanced approach towards nutrition, that we produce enough food, or there's enough food available both through local and external production, that gives a balanced diet to everybody. So people have access to healthy diets. So they could be traditional diets, they could be modern day diets, but they're healthy. And then they're sustainably produced. That is that we are not overusing our natural resources. We are using them optimally, conserving them. Where possible, we're also renewing them. And at this, reducing greenhouse gas emissions from all the sectors, the agriculture sectors that are there. That actually makes, and then using the right combination of technologies. So this could be the use of digital technologies that are used for, you know, landscape mapping, remote sensing, looking at the availability of groundwater, where it is scarce, where it needs to be used better, better varieties, better breeds of livestock, and then proper planning. What crops are good for a particular region, keeping in mind the climate and the soil and the water availability, and how it can actually help bringing in local practices. So cultural practices, mechanical practices, which many farmers and vulnerable populations, as well as indigenous people, have been practicing for years or decades, and it's which can be actually put into use and make agriculture more resilient. What this helps is to make sure that livelihoods became sustainable, that during difficult times, farmers are still assured of incomes and support. And then an important aspect here is to reduce the waste. So have economies or circular economies where the waste of one sector is an input to the other sector. And then reduce food loss and waste across the chain from farm to fork. So there are a number of these methodologies and technologies which can be brought in to ensure that the food system becomes more innovative, is more resilient, and more, you know, resistant to some of these crises that keep coming. I mean, some of them relate to the climate. So even those will we have to be careful about.